You're listening to Dr. Barry Dworkin on Sunday House Call.
Welcome back. We're in conversation with Dan Gardner, Ottawa citizen journalist and author of Risk, The Science and Politics of Fear. And Dan, I wanted to get to what I thought was a very important part of the book where you hear people say, we're better to be safe than sorry. News headlines will do that. Commentators will say this as their reasoning behind why we should or should not do something. And you call this the precautionary rule, and that there are at times inherent problems with that approach.
Mm-hmm. Well, the precaution—it's not my term. The precautionary principle is widely acknowledged. It's entrenched in law in various places. It's in European Union law. It's the United Nations. A very, very influential concept, and it makes good intuitive sense, right? You shouldn't have to wait until the science is absolutely certain before you take action where there is reason to believe that you are going to suffer irreparable harm, right? Mm-hmm. It's good intuitive sense. The problem is, if you stop and think about it, how exactly do you apply it when you look at the complexities of the problems you face in the full complexities? For example, chlorination of drinking water. The chlorination of drinking water produces byproducts, and those byproducts are known to be carcinogenic. And the risk is probably very, very small, but there is something there. There is some reason to be concerned. Okay. Better safe than sorry, right? Mm. We should stop chlorinating drinking water. Okay. Take out the chlorine. What happens then? Well, then you're going to have a resurgence of cholera and typhoid and goodness knows what else, right? All those other waterborne diseases that used to kill us but no longer do because mm-hmm. we chlorinate the drinking water.
Right.
Okay. So what does the precautionary principle say about those waterborne diseases? Well, better safe than sorry. You better chlorinate the drinking water. So the precautionary principle then says you should not chlorinate the drinking water, and you should chlorinate the drinking water. Mm. Okay, so what do you do? what's the guidance there? And if you look at problem after problem after problem, that same conundrum arises. For example, clothing and furniture, should you put flame retardant chemicals in them? It will save lives. Those flame retardant chemicals do save lives, in fact. There are probably people alive today, because we, in fact, do have regulations that require that to happen. Well, because we put those chemicals in those things, we now there's personal contamination. If you do blood analysis, if you check my blood right now, some of those chemicals will be in my blood, and some people claim that I am at risk of some mm-hmm. harm as a result of that. Okay, what does the precautionary principle tell us about that? On the one hand, it tells us you must put use these flame retardant chemicals. On the other hand, it says you must not use these flame retardant chemicals. Mm-hmm. So it's nice to say better safe than sorry. It's a nice sentiment, but it really doesn't get us anywhere.
There is, in the final chapter of your book, you write about a cemetery in central Ontario, I believe, where your parents used to live.
Yep.
And you walk through there. I'm going to let you tell the story and how that impacted on you with regards to, again, why we are the healthiest and safest we've been in a long time.
Well, this is a cemetery east of Parry Sound. It's a completely typical cemetery, pioneer cemetery, just a few headstones, clearing in the forest. You can find cemeteries like that anywhere. Dates from the late 19th, early 20th century. And in 1902... you look at the headstones, read the dates, read the ages, and read the dates of those headstones. Because the pioneers, of course, they all wanted to have big headstones. Mm-hmm. Why? Because death was omnipresent for them. 100 years ago, death was omnipresent for people. They wanted to have a big tombstone that would say, we existed one time. And in this little cemetery, there's a whole lot of stones that are carved with the date 1902. And one of them in particular has five children, ranging in the age from, a baby up to a 10-year-old girl. Five children who died over a period of 3 weeks. And what killed them was diphtheria. There was a wave of diphtheria went through the region at that time. Most people today don't even know what diphtheria is. Mm-hmm. You might have heard the word because when you take your baby into the doctor's office, the doctor says you're going to get a shot for X, Y, and Z, and one of the things is diphtheria. But think about that. At that time, those people knew perfectly well what diphtheria was. And the parents of those children would have known what was killing their children. They would have seen it. And they could do absolutely nothing. What a horror. What a horror. And what a horror that we have been spared.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's profoundly ungrateful for us not to be appreciative of how lucky we are today.
And yet you have small groups, sometimes large groups, getting together and saying that vaccines are harmful.
Yeah. It's this is a classic example of, well, there's a whole all sorts of things going on, ranging from historical forgetfulness right up to some very interesting cognitive psychology. But those people, what they're doing is they're looking at the infinitesimal risk, the small, slight possibility that something could go wrong with the vaccine. And in some cases with vaccines, mm-hmm. they're right. There are proven risks, very small risks, but there are risks. But they're ignoring what the risk is that the vaccine was meant to prevent and that the vaccine is preventing. And when they say, well, if my child doesn't get the vaccine, it doesn't matter. Well, that's not true. Because if it's your child and a few more children, eventually we lose what public health officials call
herd immunity.
And so your decision not to immunize your child puts others at risk. And boy, when you look back at some of those diseases and you look at the things that those vaccines have prevented, you know that the risks of the vaccine themselves are awfully small and that the benefits delivered by those vaccines are magnificent. They are huge. You should kiss vaccine makers on the lips for that.
Well, Dan, we're just about out of time and I could go on talking about the book with you for another hour or so. And it truly does, as far as I'm concerned, it does provide a framework for people to look at what is being presented to them. And if they can just step back and understand what gut and head say, that it might lead to different decisions or at least putting things in perspective for people.
That's absolutely the most fundamental thing that I hope people take away from the book is simply this. You've got to learn to think consciously and hard. Going with your gut, going with your intuition isn't good enough. You have to think hard.
Dan Gardner, Ottawa citizen journalist and author of Risk, The Science and Politics of Fear, has been with us for the past hour. And Dan, once again, absolute pleasure having you in the studio.
Thank you.
When we come back, we're taking your calls at 1-800-580-2372, 1-800-580-2372. Looking forward to speaking with you. Encourage you to call in early. Get you on the line right away. 1-800-580-2372. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call.